This is episode 308 of That Shakespeare Life. If you'd like to see special behind-the-scenes content of the making of our show, including the opportunity to submit your questions you want asked on the air, and to access over 150 additional episodes of our show not available on public listening platforms, then consider joining us as a patron on Patreon. Find out more and join us today at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife, and stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hi, I'm Helen Hackett, author of Women and Romance Fiction in the English Renaissance and of The Elizabethan Mind. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend, Cassidy Cash.
To obtain a pair of spectacles, a person would either have had to wait for a travelling peddler to knock on the door, selling directly spectacles alongside other haberdashery items, including cloths and ribbons, inkhorns, combs, hairbrushes, that sort of thing. Or they could have visited a spectacle maker's workshop.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
Shakespeare uses the word spectacles 8 times across his works and talks about glass eyes in King Lear. In A Winter's Tale, Leontes is talking with Camillo when he indicates Camillo should have seen something clearly because of the thickness of his eyeglass. It makes sense to think that people in the 16th and 17th century would have suffered from nearsightedness or farsightedness and other ophthalmological disorders, but what does the historical record show about how these sight-related issues were dealt with in Shakespeare's lifetime? Were there glasses that people wore on their face? And if so, who was making them and out of what? To help us explore the history of eyeglasses, spectacles, and the science of improving your vision for Shakespeare's lifetime, we're talking today with Dr. Neil Handley, who is not only a historian of eyewear specifically, but serves as curator of the British Optical Association Museum at the College of Optometrists in London. Dr. Neil Handley is a scientific and medical historian who has been the curator of the British Optical Association Museum at the College of Optometrists in London, the United Kingdom, for the past 25 years. He is also the chairman of the Scientific Instrument Society, a liveryman of the Worshipful Company of Spectacle Makers, an editorial advisor to the journal Ophthalmic Antiques, and author of the book Cult Eyewear. He is a past chairman of the London Museums of Health and Medicine and past president of the Ocular Heritage Society of America. You can find out more about Neil and links to some of these museums in the show notes for our episode today. Hello, Neil. Welcome to That Shakespeare Life.
Hello, Cassidy. Pleased to be with you.
First, let's talk technology. What is the difference in mechanism or components at this time between items like spectacles versus the lenses of a telescope?
Well, Cassidy, you know, I always say that spectacles are an applied technology. And back in ancient times, they had discovered and understood the ability of a curved surface to alter the pathway of a ray of light and to bend it so that the user could focus that on their retina. So that was really old knowledge. But this applied knowledge whereby the recognition of the scientific principles could then be put into a usable device, that was something that came much later. And it was successfully harnessing those principles that happened around the turn of the first millennium, around the year 1000, that led to the reading stone, which is the most basic form of vision aid, and which would still have been in use in Shakespeare's time. But that was a very simple technology. And you couldn't say that the reading stone or that any ophthalmic lens that derived from that was in any way a scientific instrument. And of course, the user of such a vision aid didn't need to understand the science behind it. They didn't need to have any interest in that science in order to benefit from it. So we're talking about unsophisticated users of unsophisticated technology devices. And most of them were quite crude and didn't help that much. Were completely useless if you were illiterate, as most people were at that time. So let's recall that Shakespeare's life dates are 1564 to 1616. And in that time, spectacles, which is when you have two lenses and you mount them together binocularly, and then you can place one lens in front of each eye. Well, they'd only been around for less than 300 years at that time. Now, those spectacles corrected presbyopic long sight, which was a condition that's age-related, and you tended to have to be age 40 or over to benefit. So many people didn't live long enough to actually get round to using them. And as I'm sure you know, in As You Like It, Act 2, Scene 7, there is that famous reference to the seven ages of man, and the sixth age is characterized with spectacles on nose and pouch on side. So they're identified with being this age-related device. But if you'd wanted spectacles to correct short sight, well, those had existed for no more than 100 years at Shakespeare's time. And they would have still have been considered a relatively new technology in Shakespeare's day. For example, in Much Ado About Nothing, Act 1, Scene 1, Benedick says, "I can see yet without spectacles." You see, he's not yet so old as to need them, but equally, that might have been his only option anyway, to manage without spectacles, as they weren't widely available and they didn't suit most people's eyes. Now, of course, if you'd wanted spectacles to correct astigmatism, well, that didn't exist at all and wouldn't for another 2.5 centuries after Shakespeare. And then, of course, in 1608, there was this big invention, which was the telescope. And Shakespeare, of course, is entering his early to mid-40s by this stage. And it was originally a spectacle maker who invented the telescope. He was called Hans Lippershey. He was in the Netherlands, in Middelburg, and that's in the Spanish Netherlands, and what would later on become part of the breakaway Dutch Republic. And everyone thought at this time that this new telescope would be, or what they called a perspective glass, would be a military weapon, and it would allow you to see ships that were far off the coast. And it was literally just two spectacle lenses joined together at either end of a tube, so a very simple construction. And it was the distance between those lenses and the ability to alter the length of the tube so that you could affect the focal length of the instrument. That was what made a difference. And this allowed this new possibility of making something that was far away seem close at hand and nearby. And they went enlarged. They were just nearer. And that was a radical new capability for that time.
Well, you've mentioned astigmatism and nearsightedness or short-sightedness, and I don't remember the term for the condition when you're older, but you've mentioned three different conditions here associated with vision. And I wonder what kind of lenses were available for vision. I mean, did they have monoculars or were binoculars primary? And one kind of glass that Shakespeare mentions in his play is called a burning glass. And I wonder if that's related to glasses for vision or something else.
Okay. Well, we know that glasses, in the more general sense, have been introduced to England during the 14th century. And there were certainly dedicated makers of them in London by the early 15th century, many of whom were, they appear to have been immigrants of Flemish origin. So yes, we can say that glasses which are specifically intended to correct poor vision or blurred sight would have been familiar to Shakespeare and his audience. And he occasionally gets quoted in this respect, and not just in the Seven Ages reference that I've mentioned. For example, in Coriolanus, Act 3, Scene 2, now, Coriolanus, he's, of course, an ancient Roman, so he pre-exists the invention of spectacles. But in the play, his character refers to the glasses of my sight, which could be an anachronistic nod to objects that were familiar in Shakespeare's own time. But it is, it has to be said, a reference that's vague and ambiguous. He says, for example, that these glasses take up his tears. And elsewhere in Love's Labour's Lost, Act 4, Scene 3, Shakespeare writes that, "Thou wilt keep my tears for glasses." So it seems that Shakespeare thinks of glasses as being containers for liquids rather than vision aids. And in any case, the main meaning of the word glasses in this period is actually the plural for mirrors. And in both Measure for Measure and in Venus and Adonis, there are references to mirror glasses as things in which you can behold yourself, things in which you can see your reflection. And in Richard II, when the king speaks to his uncle about the, quote, "the glasses of thine eyes," he's clearly referring to the reflections that he sees when gazing into the naked eye. And then another ambiguous instance is in King Lear, Act 4, Scene 6, which was written in 1605. When in the countryside outside Dover, we've got the old king, and he's wearing a very flowery costume. And he tells the Duke of Gloucester, who's probably dumbfounded at his appearance, to, quote, "get thee glass eyes." And like a scurvy politician, seem to see the things that thou dost not. Well, Cassidy, what we have here is a common trope throughout history, that somehow spectacles help us not only to combat physical blur, but to see more clearly what people mean. They give you insight as well as sight. And we have a much later engraving in our museum collection here in London, which is entitled "A Pair of Spectacles Easily Seen Through." And the suggestion is that these glasses could help you see through the lies of politicians. However, as with many phrases, there's another possibility. This phrase could mean, when it says "get thee glass eyes," it could be a reference to artificial eyes. That is, glass eyes for prosthetic use, which of course can be very convincing, but the one thing they can't do is help the user to see. So we have to be careful about how we handle apparent references in Shakespeare to what are now to us familiar words with other meanings. And so the spectacles for presbyopia or for myopia or for hypermetropia, these are things which were not necessarily clearly defined in Shakespeare's day. And no, you won't find monocles in Shakespeare because they hadn't been invented until the 1700s in Germany. And you won't find binoculars because they didn't emerge until about 1825 in France, although there were some binocular telescopes that were available to the ultra-rich shortly after Shakespeare's period in the mid-17th century. And finally, you mentioned the burning glass. Well, that's a red herring, as burning glasses were used for fire starting. And the ancient writer Archimedes even tried to weaponize them as a sort of ray gun. But as we all know from survival stories like Lord of the Flies, you can use a spectacle lens to kindle a flame, although that's never been their intended use.
I think we should make a distinction here for our listeners that spectacles mounted binocularly is different from the binoculars we think of when we want to hold it up to your eyes and see things far away. So what we're saying here is that spectacles with two lenses used simultaneously on your face did exist for Shakespeare's lifetime, but the binoculars that you would hold up like two tubes to each of your eyes to see far away, that was a technology that appeared much later. And I just thought, since the words were the same, we should point out the difference there.
And that's absolutely true. But binoculars, of course, grew out of theatre glasses. So it's quite appropriate for this particular podcast.
So were the glasses that you wear on your face to correct poor vision designed differently than a magnifying glass? You mentioned a minute ago that the changing of the focal point allowed things to appear nearer without magnifying them. So are these different constructions?
Yeah, it's largely to do with the position of use as opposed to the actual properties of the lens and the point at which it is held in order to focus on an object being close up or far away from it. So yeah, I want to make another quite fundamental point here about studying the history of spectacles and the pitfalls that lie before anyone who tries to make that attempt, that the term eyewear is itself an early 20th century term. And it developed out of eye wear, which is spelled W-A-R-E. That is tradable goods for the eyes. So early spectacles, actually, they were often not worn. They were held in the hand. And you could just about balance a pair of spectacles on your face if you stayed very still. So early spectacles, which we collectors call nose spectacles, tended to be used indoors and whilst sitting down. And this influenced their design. One of the features of them was, for example, that they should be as flat as possible because they spent more time in a case or indeed in your pocket, which you didn't want to be bulging, than they did on your nose. So you have to think of these things as being temporary use devices, and they're held, instead of close to the object being viewed, they're held close to the eyes looking at an object which is in the distance. And there are also historic drawings of people supporting their spectacles via the bridge over their ear, but worn to the side of the head. This is so they can store them there in a convenient out-of-the-way location, keeping them neatly out of the way until they're required.
Now, I've read about bow spectacles as well as rivet glasses from the 16th and 17th century. Will you describe these spectacles for us in terms of how they looked and practically how they were used?
Okay, well, in chronological order, rivet spectacles, they predate Shakespeare. They were the earliest form of binocular-mounted spectacle lenses, and they were just effectively two magnifying glasses joined together at the handle with a small rivet, and then the resulting bridge from that join still served as the handle to support the device in front of your face. And rivet spectacles were mostly used by monks and nuns. And indeed, they were manufactured in the monasteries and the convents where the demand for them lay among a literate and relatively longer-lived population. But they did still exist in Shakespeare's time. And indeed, the oldest verifiable pair of spectacles in my museum's collection in London is a silver pair of rivet spectacles that dates from about 1550. And that may well have survived to the present day precisely because it had inherent value, because it had been made from a precious metal. But anyway, over time, that rivet that joined the two handles, that was done away with, and the bridge became just a shorter connecting piece of the frame joining the two rims in a bow shape or in the shape of a letter C, so known as a C bridge. And these would have been the most popular design in Shakespeare's time. And the frames, including the rims and the bridge, would have been made out of bone, horn, leather, or even wood. And this tendency to favor natural, organic materials is driven partly by availability, because they are, after all, byproducts of the meat industry, which would be otherwise wasted, but also because, as they're natural products, they're good for coming into contact with the face. So they're like an early form of non-allergenic frame solution that prevent you from breaking out in a facial rash, which is something that can happen with some modern metals and plastics. So they were also would have been very round, much rounder perhaps than the glasses that we're familiar with today. And that was simply a byproduct of the way that the lenses were made, because they were ground on a wheel. So it was easiest to make them round. And that was really the only shape that they could cope with up until about 1800. So every spectacle wearer in Shakespeare's day looked like an owl if their glasses were supported in front of the eyes in that very round way. And as we know now, that's not a look which is sometimes considered to be aesthetically pleasing or desirable. So although there was no alternative shape available then, there was always another option, which was not to put on your glasses, not to put on something that was seen as embarrassing or disfiguring, that enlarged the eyes and drew attention, of course, in a highly visible way to the fact that you had a bodily weakness.
I saw in Optical Journal an article about spectacle sides being invented only in the 18th century, but then I noted a Spanish painting of Fernando Nino de Guevara with what appeared to be earpieces as early as 1600. So when exactly did the technology of putting earpieces to hold them onto your face actually arrive?
Okay, well, yeah, as an art historian, I spend a lot of time analyzing the evidence for spectacles in historic paintings, of which the earliest, in fact, dates back to 1352. But the Spanish painting to which you're referring, that's by El Greco, and it's a portrait of the Grand Inquisitor of Toledo, so an important religious figure and cardinal. But it's not so much that he's got earpieces as he has looped cords around his ears, and he's tied these through small holes in the rims of the spectacle frame, and then he's looped them around his ears in a manner which all your listeners will recall from those face masks that we all had to wear during the COVID pandemic. For some reason, these ear loops were popular only in Spain and in the Far East, and not in England. Never found any examples of ear loop spectacles in this country. However, I have discovered, as part of my research, a wooden carving on a dividing screen at a church in a town called Wormleighton, which happens to be in the English county of Warwickshire, so very near to where Shakespeare was born. And this carving may depict spectacles being strapped to the head. But if it does, the sculptor hasn't carved them very definitely enough for us to be sure. And this screen originally came out of another church, we know that, in a nearby town called Southam. And the church in Southam was a Tudor church, so it's spot on date, and it was built in the reign of Henry VIII. But although the carving looks like a man in a Tudor hat with spectacles with a strap on them, there is a possibility that when this church screen was moved to the church in Wormleighton, the figure may have been added then, and that would have been in the 1680s. So it may just be too late for our subject. But it would still make it the earliest sculptural reference to spectacles with sides in England. Otherwise, the addition of what we now know as sides and Americans call temples, that would have had to have waited until London in the 1720s.
And what about sunglasses?
Well, they didn't have them as we would understand the term. However, it's worth saying that because of the impurities of the optical glass that was available at that time, in fact, most spectacle lenses would have had a blue or a greenish tint to them anyway. And this was sometimes felt to have a therapeutic benefit. It could comfort tired eyes, for example, and that's something that would be much better understood only a little later on in the 17th century. For example, when Samuel Pepys went to buy a green pair of spectacles from an optician in London, and that was to relieve eye strain. And there may also have been what we sometimes call dark glasses. And there is a reference in Shakespeare's Henry VI, Part 2, Act 3, Scene 2, where Queen Margaret refers to blind and dusky spectacles. And I'm not quite sure what she is discussing here. It could be spectacles in the other sense of the word, as in a show or a scene to be beholden. But certainly there was some sort of protective shield that was available for light-sensitive patients in this time, although often they'd just use a blindfold out of cloth. And dark lenses could also have been used to conceal the ravages of a diseased eye. And that's not so much for the benefit of the patient as for those around them who want to be spared having an unpleasant view to look at. So this is an important reminder to us that spectacles are a two-way device. They're for you to see through, but also to be seen through.
What was the process in the 16th and 17th century for deciding that you needed glasses and then having some made? We've discussed a little bit the ageism related with spectacles, so that played a role. But was wearing glasses considered a medical issue where you would have to go to somebody who certified, yes, you need these, and here's how you have them made?
Well, there's always more than one way to skin a cat. So many doctors preferred to encourage their patients to take a medical approach to poor eyesight. So either a surgical intervention and you could remove cataracts, for example, in this period, or taking a trip to the apothecary for some form of medication. Now, there's a couple of interesting references here. There's the German physician George Bartisch, who was writing in 1582. He wrote that spectacles were dangerous and they could harm your eyesight, which is totally untrue, incidentally. Why did he say this? It's because he had his own range of ophthalmic medicines that he wanted you to buy instead. Meanwhile, in 1586, there is Walter Bailey. He was the personal physician to Queen Elizabeth I. And he wrote the first book in which you'll find any discussion of the value of nutrition and its importance for eyesight. And this was way ahead of its time, although in some of its details, it gets it a bit wrong and it actually clashes directly with modern advice. But it's talking about various foodstuffs like blueberries and green vegetables and the benefits or not that those may have. But what opticians are always trying to remind their patients is that just because you might see something out of focus, that's not necessarily due to disease, that you can have poor eyesight that is disease caused, but there are other causes as well. Your eye might be perfectly healthy and you might be experiencing what modern opticians would call CRE, which is correctable refractive error. And that doesn't mean that you're unwell in any way. It's just something that needs a bit of a technological help in the form of a corrective lens. So, as I said at the beginning, it was this gradual and indeed surprisingly slow adoption of an applied technology that opened our eyes to clearer vision.
Was the science and practice of optometry established for Shakespeare's lifetime?
Alas, no, although the antecedents of it were beginning to form. To obtain a pair of spectacles, a person would either have had to wait for a traveling peddler to knock on the door, selling directly spectacles alongside other haberdashery items, including cloths and ribbons, inkhorns, combs, hairbrushes, that sort of thing. Or they could have visited a spectacle maker's workshop, an industrial setting, and bought a pair directly from the maker. And there are pictures of this showing people accessing the shop via a window that opens directly onto the street. And when they got there and looked through this window, most of the frames that were available for sale, they looked the same. A lot of makers specialized in a certain frame material and didn't make any other type. And there was no difference at all between the spectacles for men or for women, nor any difference between those for young people or for old people. And there was no sight test involved. You simply sampled a few pairs by placing them in front of your eyes. And by a system of total trial and error, you came up with the lenses that suited you. And to help their customers, a few enterprising optician spectacle makers had come up with the idea of a rudimentary form of classification, dividing their spectacles into boxes of young glasses and old glasses. And old glasses didn't mean they were secondhand. It meant that they were suitable for an older age range of patients. But there was absolutely no standardization of powers and no means of measuring those powers until the 19th century. And the first actual spectacle shop, a proper retail premises specializing in the supply of vision correction devices in London at any rate, we think was that belonged to a man called Thomas Peel, and that's in 1623, so 7 years after Shakespeare. So unfortunately, I don't think that Shakespeare ever visited dispensing opticians. And then it was only very shortly after that that a City of London guild or livery company would be formed, and that went under the grand title of the Worshipful Company of Spectacle Makers. Now, that still exists. It's the oldest eyesight organization still in existence in the world. I'm a member of it. And it was granted a royal charter in 1629. Before that time, there were spectacle makers in livery companies, but they had to join another company. Most of them belonged to either the Grocers' Company or the Worshipful Company of Brewers, which conjures up interesting ideas of connections between vision and drinking. And one of the famous spectacle makers who was a member of the Brewers Company was Robert Out. And Robert Out is interesting because he, like Shakespeare, came from the English Midlands region. And in 1602, he started an apprenticeship where he was trained directly in how to be a spectacle maker. So that date marks the origin of a standalone professional training for the spectacle industry. And it's that story of a trained and organized optical profession and its related industries that forms the story that my museum will cover when it reopens in early 2024.
Now, this is obviously a wonderful world to explore in regards to the history of optometry and glasses for Shakespeare's lifetime. And certainly we would like to know more about the opportunity to visit the exhibition there at the museum and be able to take advantage of that. So I wanted to ask you if you could recommend some reliable places for us to start when we want to learn more about this topic, and then tell us about the museum and where we can visit there.
Okay, well, first of all, some reading matter. If you want something that's a good general introduction, that's very readable, not overly academic, although it does take into account a lot of the latest scholarship, I can heartily recommend Through the Looking Glasses. That was written in 2021 by Travis Elborough. And full disclosure here, I granted that author access to my private research files. So in some ways, he wrote the book that I would have written if he hadn't started it first. If you have a serious interest in collecting old spectacles as a way of tapping into the three-dimensional history of glasses, then the Bible for collectors is a book called Spectacles and Other Vision Aids, A History and Guide to Collecting, published in 1996 by the late J. William Rosenthal, who was an American ophthalmologist, and some of whose private collection now forms the basis of our sister museum in the United States, which is in San Francisco, at the American Academy of Ophthalmologists. That's a heavily illustrated, must-have guide, and I must say it also makes a good doorstop if you don't have a brick handy. I will say, however, that most collectors in this field will never be able to aspire to collect something from the Shakespearean age, because vision aids from that period are so rare indeed. Finally, the best serious study into the performance of vision aids in the 16th century is a small book by the Swiss scientist Ralph Villach. And his book is misleadingly entitled The Long Route to the Invention of the Telescope. But it's a short book, and it's mostly about spectacles, which you wouldn't guess from the title. And it contains far more technological knowledge than I, as an art historian, could ever hope to acquire. And then if you want to find out more, you can also look at the museum website for the British Optical Association Museum at the College of Optometrists. And we have lots of information there about the history of the subject and a searchable database of all the objects in our collection.
These are excellent resources. We'll place links to these in the show notes for today's episode, so you can go directly to these books and resources, as well as to be able to find the British Optical Association Museum at the College of Optometrists. We'll place a link there so you can go and explore all the wonderful things. And if you're in the area, do check out their museum exhibition. The museum is open this year, 2024, and you can see that and visit there. So definitely check that out as well. And we'll place information for you to do that in the show notes for today. Now, Neil, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life. And that's, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible. So your choice would be in addition to those.
Well, you have to excuse this moment of heresy, but I would happily forego the complete works of Shakespeare, as I'm only interested in works of nonfiction. Drama, poetry, novels, they don't do it for me, but I would derive years of interest and inspiration from another multi-volume work, which is the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, known as the ODNB, which is a masterpiece of concise summarizing of real people's lives, what they did, what they got up to, and not just what they were famous for. And the great thing about this series of volumes is they've started to add in so-called missing persons whose historical significance has perhaps been recognized only belatedly. And I'd love to see some of the pioneer ophthalmic opticians, spectacle makers and optometrists included in its pages. And maybe that's a project for me in the future.
Well, you are the first to select that book for their Desert Island selection, but I think it's a wonderful way to spend your time and a good choice for your time on your deserted island. So what are you working on now that you're excited about?
Well, we've just spent 4 years reopening the museum with a complete building refurbishment. So we're really enjoying bringing visitors back in to experience the genuine artifacts of the history of this subject. And we're looking to expand the internet pages and to do much more in the way of audiovisual content so that those people who unfortunately are just too far away to come and see us will have remote access instead. So it's that twin approach of making sure there's something on site, if you'll pardon the pun, for people to enjoy and something out there in the big wide electronic world for them to enjoy the subject too and to learn more about the importance of our eyes and eye care and looking after them, as most people only have two of them, unless you have spectacles, in which case you've got four of them.
This sounds so exciting. I can't wait to see all that the museum has to offer and definitely to check out the resources and history you've shared with us today. Neil Handley, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your history expertise to help us understand the site history and the history of eyewear in Shakespeare's lifetime this much better. It's been fun talking with you.
I'll be seeing you.
As promised, the link to find the show notes is here. You can find more information on Neil Handley in the show notes for today's episode. There's also direct links to the resources Neil mentions today that you can use to explore the history of eyewear even further. This week's show notes are equipped with detailed show notes that unlock automatically for patrons of our show. There are buttons right on the page that walk you through how to sign up or log in if you're already a patron. And when you do, there are visual elements that go along with our talk today that will expand immediately right there on the page and reveal a collection of museum artifacts, primary documents, and more in-depth history that coordinates with our conversation today. Find all of these things at CassidyCash.com/episode 308. That's CassidyCash.com/EP308. In addition to accessing the detailed show notes and visual bonus content for our episodes, patrons of That Shakespeare Life get behind-the-scenes looks at the making of our show, including the opportunity to submit their topic ideas or even specific questions they'd like to have asked to upcoming guests. Inside the patrons area, you can access over 150 additional episodes of our show not available on public listening platforms. There's also a monthly book club, virtual tours, video versions of the podcast, and educator resources, along with a collection of digital history activity kits that let you try out some of the games, recipes, and crafts you learn about here on the show, right in your home or in your classroom. There's a lot of history to explore and enjoy inside our Shakespeare History Club on Patreon. You can support our show and get access to all of these bonus extras right now on patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That's patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That Shakespeare Life is researched and produced by me, Cassidy Cash. Our audio engineer is Gary Mayholm. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learned something new about the Bard. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.